everyone. I'm your host, Mallory Mercer, Director of Advocacy and Community Engagement for the STAR Coalition. On this podcast series, we're going to shed light on some of the most stigmatized and misunderstood areas of the mental health industry. Our hope is that through this podcast, we can bring transparency and light to a system that is so heavily scrutinized. We aim to share vital information about a multitude of mental health topics while spreading the message that research equals hope. On today's episode, we're sitting down with Dr. Jill Harkavay-Friedman. Dr. Harkavay-Friedman is the Senior Vice President of Research and leads the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's research program. AFSP's research program provides funding to research grants, offers workshops and training to researchers, and disseminates research findings to increase public awareness and support advocacy in mental health and suicide prevention. With over 35 years of experience as a clinician and a suicide prevention researcher, she is passionate about translating research into practice. Dr. Harkavay-Friedman earned her BA in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and her PhD in clinical psychology at the University of Florida. She completed her internship at Yale New Haven Hospital. In 1984, she joined Montefiore Medical Center, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, establishing the Adolescent Depression and Suicide Program. In 1989, she moved to Columbia University, New York State Psychiatric Institute, where she is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry. She joined the staff at AFST in 2011. She maintains a clinical practice in Manhattan. Dr. Harkavay-Friedman has been an integral member of the STAR Coalition from its inception. Today's episode talks about suicidality, so I would like to give a warning to our viewers. I would like to dedicate today's episode to two people that have created a tremendous impact on my life and have made me realize the immense toll that suicide leaves with loved ones. These individuals have shaped my life significantly, fueling my passion to end the stigma around mental health and suicide. Jeffrey, or Alex as we called him, Johnson, was a childhood friend growing up, and we lost him shortly after his 17th birthday in 2015. Alex was known to be sensitive, caring, goofy, and so loved by everyone around him. He was a typical teenager that had mental health battles that he did not share with many of his peers. His family started a Facebook page called Alex's Army, where they share the raw grief and emotion behind losing a loved one to suicide, but also to share Alex's legacy. Their transparency and advocacy through heartbreak has helped so many, including myself. The other person I would like to dedicate today's episode to is Andrew Hyatt, or Philly, as we all lovingly called him. Andrew was like a big brother to me and lived with my family for a few years. Philly made the best fish for dinner, tutored me very patiently in math, and played his guitar on the back porch for us for hours. Andrew was very open with us about his internal struggles and dealt with them for many years before we lost him in 2014. Andrew will always be remembered by his loved ones as a goofball, but also someone who you could always confide in and count on for a serious conversation and wonderful advice. I'm so thankful for the impact that Alex and Philly had on my life and the way that they have affected my path moving forward. I will always work to remember Alex and Philly as the funny guys that they were and make sure that their legacy lives on. Hi, Jill. Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode to kick off September Suicide Prevention Month and Suicide Prevention Day, which falls on September the 10th this year. We're so grateful for your time and for your advocacy.
Hi, Mallory. It's so good to be with you today.
Why don't you tell us exactly what AFSP is and what the mission is behind your organization?
So AFSP stands for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and our vision is for a world without suicide, and our mission is to save lives and bring hope to those affected by suicide. And we do this through research, education, advocacy, and support for those who are affected by suicide.
We are so thankful for your organization and for your involvement in the STAR Coalition. I know that you were one of the main players in starting this coalition. Can you tell me how long you've been in this field and how it's evolved since you first started?
So I've been in this field since 1985, so I think that's about 37 years. I started my first job, and the chairman of my department wanted someone to study adolescent suicide and just start an adolescent suicide clinic, and nobody would pick it up. For 3 years, he tried. And I came along, I was a young PhD, and I was like, I'll do it. And so honestly, that's how I got into suicide prevention. But I've been very passionate about it, and ultimately, many years in, because my family knew I did this work, I found out that my great-grandfather died by suicide. And I think that's kind of emblematic. When I got in the field, nobody talked about it, except maybe in the ladies' room. I was always cornered and asked, you know, I have a family member who, or what causes it? Or, and the truth is, and now we know that over half of people have been affected by suicide. But it was a big secret. And because of that, many people suffered. People who were at risk for suicide, who didn't want to talk about it, as well as people who lost people to suicide. So I've seen tremendous growth over the years. And I have to say, I attribute a lot of that growth to the American Foundation for Suicide. In 1992, I got my first grant. I was at Columbia University, where I'm still on the faculty. And I got my first grant from AFSP. And I did what we hope many researchers would do, which is I was able to use the data from that study. I studied people with schizophrenia, which it turns out the rate of suicide is actually quite high among people with schizophrenia. And I used those data to obtain a grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to study it further. So now we have World Suicide Prevention Day, and we know that talking about suicide, allowing those conversations to happen, and allowing people to talk about it enough to get help if they're struggling is really key. And keeping it a secret actually can make things worse. So I've seen tremendous growth. Our research program started with 3 grants for a total of $11,000. And this year we're funding 34 grants for a total of $8.2 million. And that's because research has told us more and more about suicide, and it's led to the development of interventions that are quite effective.
I'm so thankful that you talk about the progression of where we've come from. And I think that we still have a very long way to go, but it's very encouraging to know that it is starting to be spoken about. And you mentioned that over half of people will be affected by suicide in their lifetime. That is very overwhelming to me, and I'm sure to all of our listeners. So with that much of an impact, can you talk about how everyone can be involved in ending the stigma against suicide and prevention?
Every single one of us can be involved in suicide prevention in some way. It doesn't mean everybody has to become a therapist. But what it does mean is that we all need to learn how to have a conversation with someone who may be thinking about suicide or at risk for suicide without panicking or calling the police. Because the truth is, the most recent survey, about 12 million people have thought about it in this country. About 1.2 million have actually made some type of suicide attempt, and over 45,000 have actually died by suicide. But as you can see, way more people experience ideation than die by suicide, and they're not the same. This is not a continuum. You don't go from thinking to acting to dying. Within a person, you might, but not every person who thinks about it goes on that trajectory. They're more like, remember those Venn diagrams of the overlapping circles? It's more like there's a little bit of overlap in each group, but there are also distinctions between those groups. And that's what we're trying to figure out with research. Okay, so back to how we can all play a role. So one is to get educated, to learn about risk factors, warning signs, and how to have a conversation. And we have so much material at afsp.org where you can learn that. Now, we do that also through education programs. We have chapters in all 50 states. And what our chapter out in Puerto Rico, we have a chapter in Puerto Rico now. And what we do with our chapters is go into local communities to educate people about suicide and how to prevent suicide. We also have our walks, which puts a face on suicide and also provides support for people who are affected by suicide or love someone who's been affected by suicide. So we're in all the communities. And so what we do, we have a program called Talk Saves Lives. And it's based on the research finding that talking about it actually makes people feel better, not worse. And the taboo is not about talking about it. The taboo is about not killing yourself. So we're all in the same place on that, right? We want to save lives. We can't save every life, just like we can't save every life of people who have heart disease or diabetes, but we can engage in some prevention acts And then some people will then not go on to die by suicide who might have been because of risk. So one is to educate. So we have Talk Saves Lives, which is kind of like the 101 of suicide prevention. It talks about how many people are affected by it, risk factors, warning signs, a little bit about what we learned from research. And it gives you the language and an action plan. If you are worried about someone, you know, how do you have that conversation and what should you do? We have guides on our website, again, afsps.org. It's actually hashtag real convo guides to help people understand that you can have a non-judgmental, open conversation to find out if someone is in so much distress that they're thinking about killing themselves. And together you can figure out a plan. So that's one way, is just learning how to talk about it, learning about it, and then acting on what you've learned. Another way that you can play a role is also to get the people around you to get educated. And that includes your friends, but it also includes your physicians, your veterinarian. We actually are working with the Veterinarian Association and have a program for them. So really everybody in your community can learn to play a role. And part of that role is just to be open to letting people talk about it and helping them get help. Another way you can play a role is by advocating for legislation that's related to mental health and suicide prevention. And so you may have heard about 988, which is the new rollout of the mental health and crisis number. Well, that came from years of advocating for a true national hotline and also to build crisis centers and mental health centers to provide the infrastructure. Because if people are calling, we want them to have a place to go get help. And different people need different kinds of help. So we have been advocating for the crisis line and for crisis centers. Another thing we've been advocating for is a database about people who die by suicide, because you can't interview them. You can't go up to them and ask them. So you do, with information that's been obtained, we can learn something about them. And so now we have the National Violent Death Reporting System. And it took many years of advocacy, but we did it. So if you want to be an advocate, just come to our website, afsp.org. It's really simple. You put in your name and address, and if there's an issue that's coming up, we give you a sample letter and you can fill in. We have a little paragraph, so you can fill in your own thing, which of course I always do because I always have more to say, but you can just send it off as is and it goes to your legislators. We also have developed mental health days in all 50 states, so you can speak with your local legislators, because things happen both federally and on the local level. So you can get educated, you can become an advocate, you could support research, which is what I do. I'm the Senior Vice President of Research at AFSP, and we give out, as I mentioned, research grants. You know, research isn't a one and done. You don't do a study, find out a fact, and then you use it. It's a process of inquiry. It's a process of asking about things. So supporting research, but also learning what the research has found. So we have what I call the video Wikipedia of suicide prevention. We have over 100 little 1 to 2 minute films where if you have a question about suicide, one of our researchers may be answering it in a little 1 to 2 minute video. And you can go to that at afsp.org/learningmore. Or you can sign up to get our Research Connection newsletter or read our blog. So research is a big part of what we do, and then we disseminate that. But we also need to support people who've been affected by suicide. And in the olden days, not only did those people not get support, but people used to run away because they didn't know what to say. But the truth is, showing up is the most important part. And so helping people to understand how to help people who've just made a suicide attempt or have lost someone to suicide makes a huge difference for the person who was struggling, but also for you as a friend or a family member to help you understand what your role can be. So, because we do know that people who've made attempts and people who've died by suicide might be at increased risk for suicide death themselves. So you can learn to support somebody who's been affected. So that's a lot of different ways that you can play a role. We also have programs for schools. We have what we call More Than Sad, which has a teacher component, a student component, and a parents component. Our chapter members bring those to their communities and start those conversations to educate people. Okay, I said a lot.
That's okay. You gave some seriously insightful information, and I just want our listeners to know that within our resource notes from today's call, we will have all of those links available to them, and I really do encourage everyone to take a look at that because AFSP's website is insane, very helpful. Pretty much any question that you may have, AFSP's site covers it. It is one of the most in-depth sites with data and backing and personal stories, and it's very sobering, honestly, to look at that website and just see the impact that suicide has on everyone's life and to know the data of how many people are affected by suicide or suicide attempts makes you realize that in everyday conversation that you may be having with a stranger, that person could be struggling, and it is so important what you say to them and how you come across as an ally and someone who wants to support them. So I know there's many questions that I have stemming from all the information that you just gave us, but my most important one is the terminology. When you're speaking to somebody, and it can be a total stranger that you may not even know has had an attempt or has a loved one that has completed suicide, I want to know about that terminology. I want to know how the best way is to ensure that we're being sensitive to the topic, but also not tiptoeing around it. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, I would love to expand on how we talk about suicide because it's changed. And so it may take a little while to get used to. And so I think the first thing to think about is that we no longer say that someone committed suicide because that implies that it's a crime. Unfortunately, in some places of the world, they don't realize that it's a health condition, not a crime, that people don't choose, you know, they, even if they look like they're choosing to do it, it's because their mental health and their brain is functioning in a way that they don't have access to their capacities, not that they don't have capacity. So we don't say committed suicide like any health condition. We would say died by suicide or killed themselves, but the preferable term is died by suicide. You don't get a rating of a person's suicide attempt. They used to say failed or successful attempt. This is not the Olympics. And also, it doesn't make sense to say that somebody failed because they lived and somebody succeeded because they died. I mean, that's just illogical. So we just say a suicide attempt. Somebody made a suicide attempt or they died by suicide. And when you're having a conversation, you might feel uncomfortable because it's an uncomfortable topic. And because especially when you care about someone, you don't want them to be struggling. But the idea is to not judge them, to understand that they don't feel well and that they may not be thinking as flexibly and as clearly as they normally do. They may not have access, as I said, to their usual coping. We know that the brains of people who die by suicide are different. Now, they're not permanently different. We also know that therapy, for instance, and medications change the brain, so it's not one and done, but the brains are different. And one of the things that happens is that people have less what we call cognitive flexibility. So they have less ability to shift gears, to problem solve. They can only see the rewards in front of them. They can't see the rewards beyond that. And so that kind of thinking is part of what the therapies work to change. So we also, one of the things, this is not a conversation, but it's an environmental factor, is we try to limit access to lethal means. Because for not everybody, but for many, the actual suicidal behavior may come with a quick thought and an action. Now, it's not like anybody will just do that. People who do make attempts have certain risk factors, and those risk factors include mental health, even though most people with mental health problems don't take their lives. So having a mental health condition, usually more than one, often a substance is involved in that, but not always. They might have a family history of suicide. They might have a head injury that affects the part of the brain or affects their life in a way. Genetics plays a role, the genes, how somebody copes with stress, how sensitive they are to stress, and how reactive they are to stress. Those have been found to be related to suicide. So there's a whole child adverse events which have an impact on the brain and your whole personhood or trauma. These things can increase the risk that somebody might have for suicide. And it's not if you have one of them, you're at risk. But even if you're at risk, it doesn't mean that you're going to act on it. And then there's the things that happen in the environment, the job loss, the bullying, the financial problems, the breakup of a relationship. Now, those things in and of themselves don't cause suicide. Most of us have experienced some of those things, and we don't take our lives or try to. But if you are at risk, then those things may play a role, may precipitate suicidal behavior. And then I'm getting back to access to lethal means, because guess what? The only way to kill yourself is to have access to lethal means. So if you don't have access, you might do something, but you won't die from it. And that gives an opportunity to improve your life and develop a life worth living. So taking care of your environment when you're worried about someone and trust your gut is another way to approach suicide prevention. If you have lethal means in your home, the best option is to take them out. Sometimes that's not feasible. Then lock them up. Make sure that the other person can't get to them. And you can do that with a conversation with the person. You don't have to secretly go in there and hide it. You can say, I'm worried about you, so I want to make sure it's safe so that if you get to the point where you want to hurt yourself, that you'll be safe so you can get through it. Because we know that most people who make a suicide attempt, more than 90%, go on to stay engaged in life and they do not die by suicide. So there's a lot of flexibility here. And so that's also about not being judgmental, not trying to solve their problems, but asking them what they might need and having a conversation.
And I think that touching on a loved one, you know, that can be so emotionally charged. A lot of us might have that experience of having a loved one and feeling so helpless, saying things that you don't mean, but that are emotionally charged that could amplify a situation is so easy. And there are resources on AFSP's website that can guide you on how to have that conversation in a way that is not emotionally charged. Because as upsetting as it may be, the conversation is not about you and it's not about your emotions. And I think that's something that can be very hard to put to the side. And so I want to speak about the times when someone does commit suicide. They die by suicide. And I keep catching myself when I'm talking about this.
My
terminology is still, I'm working on it. I work in mental health and sometimes I still use the wrong words. And so it's just a constant practice. But I do want to talk about the aftermath. If that does occur, how do you speak to the loved ones and how do you encourage them to continue to speak about the person that they lost? Because like you said, you didn't even know you had a family member that died by suicide, and that could have really impacted you if you ever were having those thoughts yourself, not knowing how to handle them. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So when someone dies by suicide, you know, it impacts so many people. Actually, the research suggests it impacts almost 150 people when somebody dies by suicide, because you're talking about family, friends, community, law enforcement. So when somebody dies by suicide, the person is grieving. They're also asking why. They're often feeling guilt, which I've learned to think that guilt, that I should have done something, is really I wish I could have done something. And healing is a long process. It's not how they look to you when they have the immediate loss. It's going to be different from how they look a year or two down the road. So one thing I would say is check in regularly. Try to come and just be present. You can't fix it for them, but you can hold their hand while they're walking that journey, grief and healing. They're not going to forget about it. Even sometimes when somebody has struggled so hard that there's a sense of relief, it's still the person has lost someone they love. It's natural sometimes to be angry at the person, to feel relief, to feel, the person who's lost someone. So you have a cascade of feelings. And so as a friend or a family member, just being there, listening, a hug. Often when someone loses someone to suicide, it's a surprise. It's not really a surprise. And so this is part of the hard part. When you learn about suicide and risk factors and warning signs and you go backwards, you also learn about what you might have not seen. And that's a hard process. And what we found is that people who can share their stories openly and also get support from others, not only do they heal more effectively, but they also may experience what we call post-traumatic growth. In other words, all our volunteers. So AFSP is primarily a volunteer organization, and we have hundreds of thousands of volunteers. And working to prevent suicide for other people is a sign of post-traumatic growth. So checking in regularly with the person, bringing them food and just the basics. Because a lot of times, because it feels like a surprise, people can barely breathe. So just reminding them to take a breath, that it's going to be step by step, and slowly they will get back into life. If you see that someone's not getting back into life, they may still be grieving, but if they're really stuck and longing for the person and not able to think about anybody else, and they don't seem to be healing, then they may have what's called complicated grief. And there's complicated grief treatment that works very well for people who lost someone to suicide. Now it actually is considered prolonged grief disorder. It was called complicated grief because, like, if you have an operation and you have an infection afterwards, so you're not healing properly, that was the idea of it. Remember that when you heal, you will still have scar or the feelings. It doesn't become an okay that the person was lost to suicide, you know, just like anybody else that we lose. Unfortunately, the way the person dies adds a whole other layer on. So we're not saying the person's going to forget. We're just saying that eventually they will get back to life. They might even engage in positive growth activities to help other people. You don't have to tell them it's going to get better. You just tell them, I'm here for you.
I think that's one of the hardest parts about being there for someone who's lost somebody is that sometimes, no matter how many amazing things someone did in their life, some people still have that stigma shield, and their life comes down to how they left their life. And so it definitely adds another layer and another dimension to the grieving process. So, Jill, you mentioned warning signs that loved ones could potentially look out for. Can you tell us a little bit about what those warning signs might be and ways that you can intervene?
Some of the warning signs, if someone is not feeling well and may be at risk for suicide in the moment, have to do with how they talk, how they behave, and what they feel like, their mood. So they may say something like, I'm just a burden, you'll be better off if I'm not here. I want to kill myself. They may just say that. They may say that life isn't worth living. You won't have to worry about me this time next year. Anything that indicates that they're feeling desperate and they just want to stop the pain. Because that's the thing about suicide. Many times they're not even thinking about killing themselves. They just want to stop the pain. So they may say those kinds of things. Then there's the behavior that they may engage in. So first of all, trouble sleeping, either too much or too little. Trouble with eating, too much or too little. Substances and increased use of substances. Agitation or reckless behavior. Because if you think about reckless behavior, the whole point of that is you don't care what happens. So whether it's, you know, rollerblading without a helmet or, you know, wildly or walking through the streets at 3 a.m. because you don't care what happens, that's a concern. Also, people tend to withdraw from things they used to do and isolate from people. Connection is really strong when you're talking about suicide prevention. And when people are in that state, they have a difficulty making connections with other people, and so they may pull back, and that's a time to reach out. In terms of mood, you know, we all think about depression, but not everybody who takes their life is experiencing a clinical depression, even if they might have depressed mood. So they may actually be apathetic, but they don't care. They may be agitated and irritable, and oftentimes people feel hopeless. Like nothing will change. I do want to add one thing to the behaviors, which is that sometimes people will give away things that are important to them. You know, I really want you to have this because you're important to me. They don't add them because I'm not going to be here down the road. So if you see a bunch of these warning signs, have that conversation. Check in with them. You don't have to start with suicide. You can start with, I noticed that you've been missing class, or you haven't come to club, or you've been absent from work. What's going on? You okay? And then you can say, well, sometimes when people feel like that, they think about taking their lives. Have you had those thoughts?
And, you know, one of the reasons that I am so invested in suicide prevention is because I have lost people that I love. And so, you know, one of the things that I go back to for one of those individuals, his name was Alex, and I lost him in high school. He was a friend growing up, and it was so interesting looking back because he was such a happy guy, and especially in the days leading up to him taking his life. So could you maybe talk about the shift in that? Everyone assumes that if you have a major swing in your mood and you're super happy that nothing is going on or that you're not at risk. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that may play a role in a warning sign?
Sure. So, you know, there are many thoughts about that. Unfortunately, we don't have real data about that because when somebody dies, we can't ask them. But sometimes when people who have been thinking about it for a long time and they feel like they're going to be out of pain and they have a plan of what they're going to do, they may feel relief. And so they may look even better than usual. The other thing is that what people look like on the outside and what they're feeling on the inside can be very, very different. And so I just listed off all these warning signs, but not everybody shows them. And that's why it's important to have those conversations. Truth is, usually they also show some of them, but they may not be as visible. And think about it, you know, we're very forgiving. You know, somebody's late or they don't show up or they're pulling back. Oh, they have a bad teacher. They hate their boss. It's a rough week. It's a rough month. It's a rough year. And so we don't go automatically like, I wonder if they're really struggling. And so that's the thing we have to remind ourselves is like, yes, we want everything to be okay, but let's find out if it is. But people can be very good at hiding what they're feeling, particularly when they're on a pathway to suicide. And again, as I said, if they look even better at that time, it could be because they have a feeling that they're going to escape the pain that they're experiencing.
Thanks for shedding some insight on that, because I think that is another factor that can make it so shocking. And it's another important reminder that it does not matter what someone looks like on the outside, how happy you perceive them to be. It's always important to show compassion. So thank you for that. You mentioned clinician education, and that is a key factor. Clinicians are sometimes our front line for dealing with suicide and suicide prevention. So could you talk about clinician education a little bit?
You know, we keep telling people, get mental health, help, get help. But we have to actually train up our clinicians because the interventions that we have now are relatively new. So a lot of clinicians have never been trained on these interventions, and they may not even know they exist. So we need to not only provide education about how does suicide work, risk factors and warning signs, but also how do they have a conversation with someone? What do they do when someone that they're treating is at risk or if they've lost someone to suicide or someone has just made an attempt and they're coming back to the practice? And also to get training on the interventions, cognitive behavior therapy for suicide prevention, dialectical behavior therapy, attachment-based family therapy, and collaborative assessment and management of suicidality. There are also interventions like safety planning and crisis response planning that are offered, and lethal means counseling, that offer tools to set the person up with a plan of how they can help themselves if they go to that suicidal place. Because that's kind of how suicidal ideation and risk goes. It's not you're either at risk or you're not, but it moves. It vacillates up and down, and it can be for a long time and then not, or very rapid, 10 minutes. And then back down. So something like a safety plan gives someone a documented plan so in a crisis they don't have to think about it. So there are tools that clinicians just simply need to learn about. And the training for most of them is pretty basic. You need the training, you need the practice, but it's very doable. And it's really important to train yourself up, especially based on what a clinician sees in their practice. And you can pick the intervention accordingly. You can't just treat the mental health condition. You have to treat the mental health condition, but just treating the mental health condition without addressing the suicide risk, and for many people, it's not enough. You have to learn suicide prevention tools as well.
And I think that that goes back into this is everybody needs to be involved. I have worked in clinics that were not focused on mental health, that were focused on other health areas. And everybody, when you go in for a checkup at your primary care doctor or at your cardiologist, you have to ask them, are you having or have you had suicidal ideation? And it was so interesting to me as someone with a psych background, when people said yes, you know, how that was handled. A lot of people steer away from that or freak out, leave the room, go grab the doctor, say, I don't know what to do. And people are asking for help. There have been so many opportunities where I've had a complete stranger sitting across from me say, I have had suicidal ideations in the past few days. And for them to open up to me shows that they're asking, they want help, they're begging for help. And not knowing your resources and not knowing how to support them in that time could be life or death for them. So that just having everyone involved, especially clinicians, and increasing their education is so important. And you mentioned on having resources at hand, having a training available. So I want to mention, you know, you were heavily involved in our STAR 911 program. So can you talk about research and how researchers can be involved? Because as we know, if someone is currently suicidal, they cannot be enrolled in the study. But how can researchers support individuals that are struggling with ideation?
Actually, people who are at risk for suicide need to be included in clinical trials, because very often the treatments and interventions that are being developed, you know, with a third of people with mental health conditions thinking about suicide and being at risk, who are we going to help if we eliminate a third of people? So the truth is that we need to include people who are at risk for suicide. But at times, for particular trials, it may not be appropriate. And so the STAR 911 project, which is very dear to me, is the idea that if you're not going to include someone in a trial because of them having an increased suicide risk, or merely because at some point they've thought about it or made an attempt, which, by the way, doesn't mean they're at risk at that moment, you know, those people really want, they're looking for something that's going to help them. So if you're going to eliminate them from your clinical trial, then it's really important to do it in a respectful way. And the STAR 911 program, it's just a six-minute video that trains people how to give the potential research participant the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number when you say, I'm sorry, you're not eligible to be included in our study. And, you know, it's 6 minutes, because if you have a clinician, then you say, we're glad you're in treatment. Let me give you this number to write down just in case. If they're not in treatment, in addition to encouraging them, you may say, but I want you to know, and please take out pencil and paper. Here's a number you can call at any time. And now it's 988, so it's even easier. But one way or another, to let them know that they're not alone, and if they need to talk to someone, 988 is there.
And the great thing about 988 is it also can offer a warm handoff. If you're afraid to make that first call and reach out for help, a lot of times the research site can help you, can make that process a little bit easier. And I think that it's so easy to know if someone tells you, oh, thank you, now you're not eligible to be in this research trial. It can be so disheartening because you are being honest with your situation. And so that's just one way that sites can show that they truly care for the individual. And we're so thankful for you and for your assistance in creating STAR 911, because that is just one of the ways that we can really give back to our communities and show a deeper support than just the research level. So thank you so much for that.
I think the point that you made, that the research site can connect you with 988. And why 988? Because they can connect you with care. You know, you can call a clinician or whatever, but if you're in an emergency, or if you care about someone who's in an emergency and don't know what to do to help them, you can call 988 and they will help you. And if they know where you are, which they wouldn't, they, you know, it's assigned by area codes. But these days, the problem is that people have moved and they still have the same phone number from 10 years ago and they're in a different state. But if they know where you are, they can help give you local resources. So it's not just, you know, I'm in an emergency, call the police. That's not the point of 988 at all. That's what happens as a last resort.
Absolutely. Thank you for that clarification. And I know that if you call 988 and you need assistance and you're able to give them your area, they will do anything they can to help. But this industry as a whole, the research industry, it's here to support you, whether you are an active participant in research, a future participant in research, or just a loved one. We are here to support you, and we want to build those relationships with our community. So before we end this episode, you mentioned 988 and a little bit of legislation. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about how you see the future of 988 being involved in suicide prevention and what we can do to support this in our state. So I'll let you go ahead and explain that for us a little bit.
988, which is really the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, but instead of having to dial 1-800-273-8255, you can dial 988. The 1-800-273-8255 will still be available. So you can support it, because this is it's a federal legislation. The actual support, or some of the support for the network, happens at the state level. And so states are asked to contribute to the development and maintenance. And many states are doing that by adding something as simple as a penny tax to the phone bill, which, by the way, is how 911 is funded. So it doesn't have to be a big burden on an individual level, but it adds up. So be an advocate in your state to make sure that your state is providing funds to support 988 and also crisis services. And then share that information so people know it's available.
Absolutely. And I just want to reiterate again that all of the resources that Jill has talked about today will be on our call note. If anybody listening to this episode has any specific questions, you can email me at Mallory@thestar.org, and you can make your subject line Ask Dr. Jill Arkavay Friedman, and we will get those questions to her. So thank you, Jill, for your time today. We really appreciate your openness and your candidness about such a stigmatized topic as suicide and suicide prevention. So thank you so much. We appreciate you, and I hope that someone learned something on this episode, and with that, you can take it to your community and try to be a key player in ending suicide.
I want to thank you, Mallory, and the STAR Coalition for talking about this topic, for bringing me as representative of American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and helping to increase the conversation to save lives and bring hope to those affected by suicide.
Thank you. And we're excited to kick off Suicide Prevention Month and Suicide Prevention Week. So be on the lookout for those resources that we will share on all of our social media sites, and make sure to share them as well.